But sometimes we let our monogamy hold the whole show up for us. I recognize this when I'm doing, so I study jealousy professionally. And when I do interviews with monogamous folks, sometimes they'll describe to me the rules in their relationship. And I'll say, cool, how did you develop those rules? How do you know? A frequent answer is, you know, the rules. Like, just, you know, the rules. He knows the rules. So that's just how they are. And I'm like, tell me more. Often there was never a real conversation where, or really a set of conversations over a course of years. Instead, what there was is bumping up against ouches for each other, right? So somebody starts calling their friends late at night and having extended phone conversations with people of a gender that they're attracted to late at night. That hurts the other partner. Now they've had this rupture, they repair it, and now there's a rule in place. You don't do that. But not an explicit rule, it's just a known rule. That hurts me, so don't do it.
Welcome to Vaginas, Vulvas, and Vibrators with Jordan Donnell. This is a safe place to learn about women's health and sexual wellness. I'm your host, Jordan Donnell, physician assistant, women's sexual health educator, and intimacy coach. On today's podcast, Dr. Jolie Hamilton, a relationship coach for couples who color outside of the lines, is joining me to talk all about individuation in relationships and non-monogamy and all kinds of topics and so much more. She is a research psychologist, TEDx speaker, best-selling author, and ASEC certified sex educator. Jolie also co-hosts the Playing with Fire podcast with her anchor partner, Ken. All right, Jolie, I'm so excited to chat with you about a variety of topics today, but especially one that I think is important to discuss in the context of relationships, which is individualization. I hope I said that right.
You got it. So close. And that's okay, because the thing is, we got to define our terms. I'm a scholar, got to define our terms. So the topic of individuation, right? Individuation, I'm using it in the sense that Carl Jung used it. So if we look at Jungian psychology, that's capital J-U-N-G, Jungian psychology, Jung named individuation as becoming the most you version of you possible, right? And in order to do that, we need to become aware of our unconscious material and start to bring it into our conscious awareness. That's not easy, but relationships are a place where we frequently find ourselves with the opportunity to expose unconscious behaviors, unconscious motivations, all those times when we're like, why am I acting like this? We do that in relationships all the time. And so by starting to notice where we are acting out of integrity or out of congruence with our own sense of who we are, we have an opportunity to grow psychologically. So individuation relationships are ones where we are focusing on making space for each other, intentionally growing and changing over time with real clarity around like, yep, that means the unconscious junk is going to come up and we're going to deal with it.
Ooh, how, you know, when you say this, the first thing that comes to mind is like in relationship, people change and potentially growing apart when there is change. So how do you go through this process and grow together rather than apart?
Okay, I think that's a delicious question. So the metaphor, right, of growing together or growing apart, I think takes us someplace interesting. So the image that I have of my own anchor partnership, the one where I have this one relationship where I own a house with somebody and I raise some children with them. I don't actually prioritize growing together with that person. Because to me, I actually take it, I sort of literalize the metaphor to see, what do I want to do with that? Do I want to grow into being one solid tree? I don't. Personally, I want to be able to maintain my own growth path, but grow alongside this person and ideally not grow so far apart that we no longer want to be with each other. So I think there's something to asking that question and saying, well, how do we want to grow together? Because some people really do want to grow together in a really sort of literal way. They want to become ever closer. And if you want that, I'll co-sign it. Okay, cool. But for a lot of people, I think what they want is actually to allow themselves and their partners to grow at whatever rate and in whatever direction feels right for them. And that means making space for the fact that there may be times where it feels like we're growing apart, and then we may sort of lean back in, and our trees may grow in these ways that don't look like the straight and narrow. That's where I specialize, because I think that's the kind of normal messiness that life really loves and thrives.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I love that metaphor, because I think that if you think of a tree, like our branches are, they're going in different directions,
right?
But it's still got a root, right? It's still got a base, the trunk of the tree. And so that metaphor, I think, is a really great way for expressing this concept. What kind of couple is individualization? I'm going to butcher that this whole time. Individuation.
There you go. So I love that you're playing with the word, because here's the thing. So this word gets tossed out there and a lot of people conflate it. They imagine that individuation means that we are over-focusing on ourselves and we're not paying attention to who our partners are. But you just asked me a really good question. What kind of couple might want to consider this? And what I have seen over the years is it's the kind of people who happen to be either single right now or in a couple right now, and they want to prioritize growth over comfort. So there's nothing wrong with comfort. I am all for my big pink squishy couch and a big blanket over it and my cocoa. But when it comes to our relationships, a lot of us seek so much comfort that we don't grow really much at all. We become very stagnant. And so people who are game to prioritize growth over their temporary comfort, they're ideal candidates for considering this individuation-oriented relationship, because it offers you the opportunity to reframe when you find yourselves sort of apart, or when you find that one of you is growing faster or in a different way than one expected, because all of these can now be looked at, oh, this is our individuation work. It's okay that we're not on the exact same track. It actually could be really good news. So if you're that kind of person, this is the relationship style for you.
Mm. What's interesting is that, like, I'm in kind of this sex and intimacy space, right? I have never heard of this word until I came in contact with you. And then ironically, I was recording another podcast earlier today and the word came up again. And I was just like, this is crazy. Like, I haven't heard of this concept before. And I love this take on growth within a relationship and this concept. How is this different from codependency?
Yeah. Okay. So first off, when I talk about this, when I talk about individuation relationships, a lot of people say, oh, you mean the opposite of codependency then, right? If we're individuating, then we're prioritizing our individual growth and we're not worried about enmeshing. In fact, we can't enmesh. But the word codependency has been weaponized a bit lately. And I like to just name the fact that it's okay to have needs and wants and to want your partner to meet those needs. So I like to get really specific and say, even if you choose codependency, if you choose a life of full enmeshment, like you want to grow ever closer, I think that's fine if that's what you're doing consciously. I don't think it will necessarily lead to the happiest or most growth-oriented path you could have. But my own parents elected that style of relationship. And they actually knew it. They called it codependent. They knew it was. They knew it played into my parents' particular trauma stories, and they chose it. And this was in the 80s. I remember hearing this and thinking, as I was getting my doctorate later, like, why did my parents use that word? But there was something really profoundly honest about it, about saying, yeah, we know that technically that's unhealthy, great big air quotes around it, unhealthy, but we're going to choose it. And by deciding, by electing to and naming it, they at least both got to offer enthusiastic, informed consent. And that to me is what makes all the difference. My parents are both gone now, but I share their story because I think when people can consent fully to the relationship path they're on, there is a variety of ways that could be healthy and okay. So I wanted to name that because individuation ideally would take you away from enmeshment. But even more specifically, it'll take you out of the patterns of unconscious, unthoughtful, unreflective enmeshment. The times when we just continue to say, I have to align with my partner. Our thoughts need to align, our beliefs need to align, our values, all of it. It all needs to align so that we have the same, 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 so that we can build a life together. And anytime we don't have that, I'm going to feel threatened and it's not going to be okay. And now I'm in my trauma response. And now I'm trying to glue us back together, right? So taking a very tender look at this, I would say, can you, in good conscience, just look at your patterns of enmeshment and say, maybe I'm choosing those sometimes. And do I want to cautiously and carefully walk away from that? Individuation could be another path, one where we start really carefully examining the places where we're enmeshed and untangle them thoughtfully.
I love the way that you explained that. And I think that that's a really good point, that codependency in the space of social media and out in the world is getting a huge bad rep ultimately.
Yeah.
And I love that you use that example of your parents and saying, like, some people choose that and they willingly are wanting that. And there is nothing wrong with that. And I think that that's a really good point to make, is that we all have different relationship styles, desires, and we're going to get more into all of that here today too. But what each couple chooses when they're consciously making that decision is their choice as a relationship. And who's to say that one way is better than the other? Like, they all have their own things and there are different relationship styles for everybody.
Right. Exactly. Hear, hear. And when we defang these ideas and we take the weaponization out, right, we stop like labeling other people's relationships or the acts that they do inside of those as good, bad, or other, then we have a chance to get to know the people who are in those relationships. And that to me is key, especially as a helper. I mean, I'm coaching people who are trying to make new relationship styles and new relationship habits. Well, that's great. But if I demonize the path that they're on right now, how much help can I really be? Am I just trying to insert my value set in place of theirs? Because I don't think that really works.
Yeah. And I mean, we all have to just kind of embrace all parts. Like, the first thing that comes to mind is religion, you know, mm-hmm. and that there's a million different religions out there and not one of those is right. Every right. single person believes theirs is right. Therefore, each one is right to somebody. And it's kind of the same with relationship styles. There are many different styles, many different ways to go about having a relationship, and every single one is right for the right person. And who's to say that my relationship style is better than your relationship style? Because that's not true.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about this. So I'm polyamorous myself. And so, you know, it's a lot of people expect that I will be like proselytizing my polyamory. And I do. It's true. I help people who want to shift from monogamy to a non-monogamous or creatively monogamous paradigm. But I don't actually care what relationship style you want. What I care is that you choose what you're doing really thoughtfully and that you allow yourself the benefit of time to explore. Because most of us were presented one model, like whatever our parents did or our small community, a little bubble around us did as normal. And that's the only thing. So we go out and repeat that, but it doesn't always fit. So if we're being thoughtful about it, it also makes space for us to accept what other people are doing. So when I'm looking at someone doing relationships differently, you know, there are things that are genuinely harmful, but most behavior isn't genuinely harmful. Like, I do not want my friends to be engaging in non-consensual BDSM practices because that's not BDSM anymore. That's abuse, right? So we can draw some hard lines, but then recognize how very much gray there is.
Yes. You brought up creative monogamy. And so I would love to kind of jump into that. You know, if somebody is thinking about opening the relationship, do you recommend exploring creative monogamy while they're considering alternative relationship styles? And like, what is creative monogamy?
Yeah. Well, I think that there are a lot of ways to consider opening, but a lot of times people imagine that it's either monogamy or non-monogamy. And that makes sense, right? Because they're sort of posed as two opposites. But in fact, non-monogamy is a huge term that covers a lot of behavior. Monogamy covers a ton of different behavior, but mostly unconscious. We don't talk about it. We just say, well, you know, you just like, you do what's right, right? Like, and that covers all of monogamy. So creative monogamy is the way I talk about deciding very specifically where you want to be exclusive and where you want to be expansive in your relationships. So let's say and it doesn't matter to me whether you have a couplehood right now or whether you're single. Let's say you're reflecting on relationship structure and you look across different domains. You look across the areas of sex, sensuality, friendship, money, children. You look across these and say, do I want to be exclusive in all of these domains? Usually, people look across those domains and they're like, oh, sex. Okay, sex has to be exclusive. Oh, no, sensuality. We'll make that exclusive. Physicality. Okay, can your personal trainer touch you? Can your massage therapist? Can your best friend? Now we get over to the domain of friendship. Are you really allowed to only have one friend? Because now I think we're calling into question whether we've gone past codependency again into an abusive, controlling situation. So most people already are practicing some areas of expansiveness, but they don't necessarily name it and call it out. So creative monogamy is a way to thoughtfully explore how are we going to explore expansivity? Maybe we're going to explore it in the realm of sex, but not in deep friendships. Maybe we're going to explore it in deep friendships. Maybe we're going to explore it in business or co-parenting. Maybe we're going to explore getting really unique with our family creating structure. But maybe we do want sex to be exclusive. Or maybe we've decided that we do not participate in a sexuality at all. Like we're not doing that. So it's really about choosing exactly where we do this and then making it clear to the people that we're relating to how we do relationships. Because if we can make that clear, now whatever, no matter what your behaviors are, your paradigm will be clear. You're going to be able to share it with others. You'll be legible to others. And that makes it easier to be in relationship with everyone.
And I think those clear boundaries, clear communication about what that looks like just helps everybody understand, especially when you are looking at opening up your relationship.
Right.
What are some strategies when opening up your relationship that can help it go best?
Well, I like, let's like take it back one step. First, I like for people to think about if they're currently in a couplehood, what does opening mean? I want them to really reflect on the question, what does opening up mean? What does, in your imagination, your wildest imagination, thinking that we could just do whatever we want, what would you actually want? What do you wish this could look like? Knowing that no one's life looks exactly the way they imagine it, because life gets to have its influence on us, and we're talking about relationships with other people, which means I could go out there looking for any number of things. That doesn't mean I'm going to find it. So I want to start with the imagination. I want to start with my imagination myself before I even really try to get my partner on board. I want to even just imagine into it. What does opening mean? What is it that I'm trying to get? What need do I want to satisfy or needs do I want to satisfy? What exploration? Am I just feeling like this curiosity, this inclination? Did I see an example somewhere and that looked really good? That felt really good when I thought about it. When we start with the imagination, we have far more opportunities. Usually what happens is people start with a label. They start with a label like, say, open or polyamory or ethical non-monogamy. They start with some label. They Google it. They've now got a laundry list. Here's how we do this. And from there, they start trying to do it. This generally results in disaster, because we don't do any skill building first. And now we're actually trying to live into somebody else's imagination of what that opening would look like. So the first strategy is to start within and start letting yourself have some imaginal space without trying to make it practical out there in the world yet. And then the very next step, find yourself some resources. That resources like podcasts, resources like coaches, like therapists, resources like community. Find yourself some community. And I'm going to go way out on a limb here. Find yourself some community that's not in your fuck pool. If you're thinking about opening and you go to a local group, that's awesome. I am like so for that. But if you also only learn from the group of people you're going to try to date, there is this insular thing that can happen where now we're complaining to and asking questions to be taught of the same people, and it can get messy real fast. So I like for people to really just take a back out a little bit, widen your aperture, and look around you for many resources. Don't listen to just me. Listen to a bunch of resources and then choose one or two or three resources that are going to help you guide the first few steps.
I love that recommendation. And I love that you also pointed out, like, create your relationship that you want. Make that and define that for yourself. Don't use Google. Don't read a book and say, this is what I'm going to do. Like, create it for yourself. And I think that that's where we get lost, and that we try to fit into this box of what it should be, but we're looking at alternative relationships for other reasons. And one of those is to not fit into a box, right?
Right.
And so why are we still trying to fit into a box when I don't really know where I'm trying to go with this, but like, we're not trying to fit into a box. So stop trying to fit into a box.
Right. Well, so here's the thing. It's uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable to realize that actually we are grownups and we get to decide what our life is like. That is not comfy. So the reason that my work, I mean, my own podcast is called Playing with Fire, right? And it's about non-monogamy and individuation. Not because non-monogamy is the only way to individuate. It definitely is not. Most people do not follow that path. But because I believe that if you're doing non-monogamy, you have the opportunity to use it as individuation material, but you have to decide to. Because if you do, if you just pull one particular person's way of doing this off the shelf and say, I'm going to do it like they did it, you're not going to be presented with your own journey. That doesn't mean you shouldn't use those resources. Definitely. Like having other people's stories, hearing how people screwed it up. I mean, I did everything wrong when I set out on this path. Hearing how people have done things wrong and hearing what people are doing to help themselves through this process can give you a lot of examples. And that's helpful. So I'm all for that. But yeah, you don't have to fit into a box and you don't have to move at the same pace as anyone else. So, you know, when I jumped from a monogamous paradigm to non-monogamous, within 45 days, I had ended my marriage and I was living with a couple. I don't recommend that. It was not a good life decision. And I look back and I think that was so out of character. None of that makes sense. But I had let things build, right? And then I made decisions that didn't actually align with my full self. When you're making this choice, give yourself the grace of as much support and as much time as it needs. Because if I could give anyone one insight, it's this is a process that takes time. We don't just wake up one day and say, okay, all the rules that we thought we had that governed our relationship, those are gone. And we're going to do this all fresh. And it's just going to be, it's going to be fresh and it's going to work. Instead, we are going to have to go through deep inner changes and we're going to have to process our stuff. It's effort. And that includes sometimes, and this actually happens fairly regularly, some people go through this process of opening only to find out actually they really liked a lot of exclusivity and they don't really want to be terribly open. Maybe they decide to, yeah, maybe we'll go to play parties. Maybe we'll go to sex parties, but we don't necessarily want a third or fourth partner in our, maybe we don't. But if they did that thoughtfully over the course of time, then it doesn't have to be this horrifying thing. Instead, it can be this delicious exploration. And now their monogamy becomes something that they've chosen, selected, crafted for themselves. Whole different ball of wax.
I love the fact that you brought up time because I think so many people are like, think that they have to make a decision and act on it. When the reality is, like, this could be an entire lifetime journey of trying on a pair of pants. Do I like the way these fit or not? What about this shirt? Try this on. Does it fit? Does it not? And you keep trying on different things and seeing how different things work in your relationships to decide how you want to move forward. And if you don't like it, like, you can throw it out and go back. But
right.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Right. So it makes me think about how we often imagine that it is about even going back. But what if you actually moved forward? What if you tried something on you gained a lesson from it, you learned something really important, and now your new version of relating, it fits you better. Like, it's really like learning how to tailor your own clothes. My first degree is in fashion design. I can make clothes fit my body better than anybody else, right? And it's because I know my body. Get to know your body, get to know your soul, get to know your relationship, and now you're going to be able to custom create it. And this does require that the people that you choose to have relationships with also are willing to engage in their process. That is the piece that sometimes doesn't work out. Not everybody is going to want to engage in a fully conscious oriented, like, let's go, let's try stuff out, let's mess some stuff up and learn together.
And I think that's all relationships, whether you're talking about something in the non-monogamy world or relationships in the monogamous side of things. Like, as a single individual, I find that a lot of, there's no other way to say this, than a lot of women are doing, quote, the work. And yeah, the men are kind of playing catch up. They're not there yet. And choosing partnership with somebody who is willing to also do the work, if that's something that you value. And I think that it doesn't matter what relationship paradigm you are in, that who you choose to do partnership with is important.
Oh, yeah. Oh, heck yeah. I mean, for that matter, who I choose to be in business with. Like, I mean, even as my clients, who I choose, how much time I choose to spend with my friends, which friends, all of that. Like, whoever I fill my life with is going to have a big impact on my journey too. And this has been part of my own process, is like, how do I find the friendships, the depth of friendships that I want in order to be able to have individuation-oriented friendships? Which means at core, we have to care more about each other's growth than we do possibly rocking the boat or accidentally triggering someone. And like, we have, and in order to do that well, we have to be able to talk about disruption. We have to be able to come back together, and we have to get consent from people. Cause some people are like, nope, I'm not going to do the hard things. And we have to let those people exit stage left. I've had to do that several times, as recently as a couple years ago, like lost a best friend because, oh, they didn't want to do that work. Heartbreak. And so important to allow that relationship then to come to conclusion so that you can have space for the next thing.
Yeah. You know, there's that saying that says the five people that you spend the most time with, you become. And I really think that that's true, and that who you choose to have in your circle, friends, partners, whatever it is, you are learning and growing from them as well. And so I really think that that all aligns.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is where you can tell I care about relationships a lot, right? I will talk about friendships the same way I talk about romantic or life partnerships, because the skills of really conscious, like non-monogamous practices, they transfer to all your other relationships. Whereas monogamous skills don't necessarily all transfer. A bunch of them do, like rupture and repair translates everywhere. But creating a couple bubble doesn't necessarily transfer everywhere. Like creating a couple bubble doesn't translate to your best friendship, because then you're going to be trying to control who your best friend can be best friends with. So I like to think of the skills that I teach and that I help people practice as like, well, these are really transferable. I use a lot of my conscious non-monogamy skills with my children. I have 7 kids. I use these same skills all the time because they are relationships. We're having relationships. So it's honestly a really yummy way to start thinking about how much freedom we have to create the life we want through our relationships.
As a single woman, I find that my friendships are a really great place to practice these skills to help me in partnership and relationship. And so I love that it's all transferable, like you said. Like, you can use all of these skills in platonic, romantic, business relationships, all relationships. Like, these are key skills for communicating. These are key skills for dealing with sticky things or crunchy things. Like, we need them. We need these skills.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned that cisgender women are doing more of the emotional labor. Like, we have the studies, the data's in. We know that in heterosexual relationships, cisgender women are doing the lion's share of that growth and learning these skills and then teaching them. We're listening to more podcasts and then turning around and applying that and then trying to teach it. But I had a client recently say, and this was a cisgender guy who commented, he was like, oh, but this is like me being a white belt. Like, I'm a white belt and I'm trying to now teach other white belts. So he was using a Taekwondo metaphor to say like, oh, I barely know what I'm doing, but now I'm going to turn and try to teach people. And this is where I find it's so good if we can expand our relational horizons a little bit and think about whether you're going to be monogamous or non-monogamous, think about all the places where we have relationships and thinking about all the different places we can practice so that we're not only practicing with one other person. And this goes for the guys too. Like, figure out, how can you practice these skills of relating? Yeah, practice them at work. They're called, in the business world, they're called soft skills. They're the same skills about empathy and active listening and holding boundaries and holding your internal boundaries, all the same. So if you think that this isn't relevant or you're not going to have other places to practice it, you do. My anchor partner is a senior software architect. He uses these skills every day in his job. He's got his head stuck in the code, but there's other people on the other end of every Zoom call. So these skills they're so transferable. And that's how I often ask people to decide to invest in this work is, let's list how many places you're going to be able to apply this. Usually they find that they have at least half a dozen places that this will be applicable. Awesome. Then isn't it worth spending your time, effort, and money on learning how to do this?
Because
my answer is yes.
Yeah. And these are things we're not taught. I literally just posted on Instagram today about how when you're confident in the bedroom, it refers and transfers to all areas of life.
Yep.
And it's the same thing. Like, when you learn these skills, they transfer to everything. Boardroom,
exactly.
Bedroom, everywhere. You brought up the word couple bubble. I'm not familiar with this word. I would love for you to just tell us briefly, what is that?
Yeah. So I think Stan Patkin's work. So there are a lot of wonderful relationship counselors and therapists out there. A lot of them have gone very big and very public with their methods. And a lot of them are very clear that they are building a relationship that is between two people. And that's that. And so we get like the Gottmans with their relationship house. And like, your job is to protect against interrupters. You protect against thirds. Stan Tatkin's work tends to have that flavor too, where we're like, we want to create this solid, secure sense of the couple bubble, and we don't let those thirds interrupt. And to their credit, they're also talking about not allowing work or hobbies to completely subsume all of our attention and turn us into people who don't show up for our partners. So there's a seed in there that I really appreciate, where we want to be really conscious of the fact that our partners need our attention and our relationship deserves our effort. However, if you want to step away from the uber secure, like secure to the degree that we have like boundaries on our boundaries on our boundaries, because we are creating monogamy that is all about just the two of us, not just sexually, but like in all the ways, it can be really, really difficult to break that paradigm. And then you turn to your bookcase full of books that are telling you that the one thing you have to do is continue to resecure the relationship. I'm all for security. I love attachment theory. It's wonderful. Let's remember, it's a theory, just like all the rest of the theories. You know, I studied old school psychology, pre-behaviorism. We have to take seriously the fact that this is a lot of old white men in colonial cultures telling us all how all of our relationships have to be. Maybe we should take a breath and say, maybe that won't work for everyone. Ooh. So the couple bubble is just one metaphor that I think, yep, it works for some people. And if you want it, great. Create that boundary that is permeable only in one direction, right? Like, we only allow it to maybe permeate in friendship. We don't, you know, and we're really careful. A lot of people would talk about emotional affairs if they're talking about a couple bubble, right? They'd be folks who are like, nope, you can't have friends of the opposite gender because that would constitute an emotional affair. And for me, I'm like, okay, that's confusing because my partner and I are both queer. So I don't really understand what he and I are supposed to do with that. But if you want to be creative and if you want to start bringing some different elements, maybe you want to play sexually, play sensually, maybe you want to have really deep and profound, intimate friendships with other people, then those rules won't work. So we're going to need different skills. And luckily, there have been people practicing non-monogamy for eons. We don't actually have to reinvent the wheel. There are people out there doing this. And I mean, literally going all the way back through all of time. So if we turn to those skills, we might say, instead of a couple bubble, maybe what I want to practice is exquisite communication. Very different thing, right? Exquisite communication might be thinking about, what does my partner need to know, want to know? How do we communicate it? When do we communicate it? How do we share things that feel unshareable? How do we make practices so that we're sharing before things get difficult? How do we make regular practices? These are all just healthy habits, right, to decide to engage in. But sometimes we let our monogamy hold the whole show up for us. I recognize this when I'm doing, so I study jealousy professionally. And when I do interviews with monogamous folks, sometimes they'll describe to me the rules in their relationship. And I'll say, cool, how did you develop those rules? How do you know? A frequent answer is, you know, the rules. Like, just, you know, the rules. He knows the rules. So that's just how they are. And I'm like, tell me more. Often there was never a real conversation where, or really a set of conversations over a course of years. Instead, what there was is bumping up against ouches for each other, right? So somebody starts calling their friends late at night and having extended phone conversations with people of a gender that they're attracted to late at night. That hurts the other partner. Now they've had this rupture, they repair it, and now there's a rule in place. You don't do that. But not an explicit rule, it's just a known rule. That hurts me, so don't do it. And so over the course of months, weeks, months, years, we create these rules based on who got hurt when. And we're supposed to avoid hurting each other. There are other ways to make relationship agreements. They do take effort, but they don't require so much destructive testing.
Oh, tell me more. Like, how do you create these types of rules? Like, do you have any framework or tools to help us?
Yeah. So I take people, when people work with me, they have to work with me for a year. So when I said time is an ingredient, I meant it. My program is called the Year of Opening, and it's a year long. And my private coaching works for at least a year as well. It's a year long because we have to have time to experiment. So when I said destructive testing, so my partner trained as a chemical engineer and a physicist, right? So here he is introducing all this scientific knowledge into my brain years and years ago. And I'm like, oh, experiments. Experiments are how we, in a small environment, we try stuff out. We learn what works for us and then we adapt. Pretty simple concept. But if we do that while paying attention, now we're doing conscious, thoughtful experiments. So in the year-long process, what I do is have people go through multiple, what I call MVAs, their minimum viable agreements. You make multiple minimum viable agreement containers where we try out being expansive in different ways and having different ways of communicating about what we're doing and different ways of protecting each other or not, different ways of handling our own stuff or not. We practice that and then with the aim toward moving toward a holistic relationship agreement. And that process is, well, it's pretty elaborate. I have a lot of baseline questions that I ask people to go through, but it's not about getting to a set of rules so much as getting to a place where they have a North Star. They know what guides their relationship and they have principles, relational principles that they feel and they understand so deeply that not only do they know them in themselves and they know them in their relationship that they're building this with, but they also can communicate them to new people in their lives so that those new people can decide and can come closer or not, depending on what they like. And so that they can rewrite those rules so that all new people coming in can also be fully autonomous humans, not entering someone else's relationship, giant air quotes and insert my eye roll here, but instead can come in as whole people. And now new experiments are had and new agreements are made. In other words, it is a piece of work. It is. Yeah. It's not nothing.
Are you ready to start understanding yourself better, learning and recognizing your patterns, and really develop a relationship with yourself? If this sounds like you, the Unleashing My Power, a Women's Empowerment and Gratitude Journal is for you. This journal was specifically curated for women just like you to help you take back your power and develop and go to the next level in life. My friend Danielle and I created this journal because of our own experiences and what we were looking for in a daily practice to improve our connection to self and really become connected with ourselves. This is game-changing, and the feedback that we are getting from other women who have started using this journal is absolutely amazing. You can find it on Amazon, or you can go to jordandanelle.com/journal, and it'll take you right there. I hope you enjoy. Be sure to go snag yours right away and leave me a review. Tell us what you think about it. Slide in the DMs. I know that your life will change when you start using this journal. I talk about, like, you know, when I coach women in the world of intimacy, it's all an experiment. And I talk a lot about experiments, and relationships are the same way. It's like we are just experimenting and trying things. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's a learning opportunity, every right. single experiment. So I love that you mentioned that. You brought up jealousy, and I want to touch on this because jealousy is a very common issue in yeah. all relationship styles. Jealousy and insecurity. How do you recommend navigating when they do arise?
Okay. So jealousy is huge. Thank you for saying that jealousy comes up in all relationship styles. It does. Monogamy will not protect you from jealousy, and neither will non-monogamy. I did the research. It's just true. So when it arises, the first step is to normalize it. The emotional experience itself is normal. It shows up in babies as early as 5 and 6 months old. Like, we know jealousy shows up. We know it has roots deep, deep, deep in our psyches and our DNA. Okay. So first, let's just normalize it. We don't want to demonize our partner if they feel jealous. Also, jealousy, well, it shows up. It's been with us forever, but we don't talk about it. We talk about it really just in our romantic relationships as grownups. But when I ask people to look back over their life, I'll ask you now, Jordan, do you remember being taught about jealousy when you were little?
Never.
Do you remember getting any lessons from school, or do you, like, any religious upbringing ever mentioning it?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. The closest I've ever heard is a couple people have mentioned being told that being jealous is bad because they needed to share their toys. And a parent used the word jealousy when they actually meant the word envy. But we'll get into that in a second. Or they were taught envy is a sin. And like, envy is one of the 7 deadly sins. And that's pretty much it. So we have jealousy that shows up when you're an infant and then, like, runs your toddlerhood. Because, hello, you don't want your caregiver bond interrupted. So you get pissy if people interrupt it. Then we don't talk about it. Then you turn into a hormonal teenager and it pops up again. And we again don't talk about it, but we do write about 1 billion songs about it. We have every TV drama, every reality TV, all of our ancient mythologies, all of our great literature, right? So we're steeped in a culture that loves jealousy. It loves to hate jealousy. It loves the mess of jealousy, and it doesn't teach us anything about it. So, I mean, I just did a 3-hour masterclass on jealousy. I could literally talk about this forever. If anybody wants that, you can find it at jealousymasterclass.com. It's there. It exists. I go into the mythology of it and the typology of it. But here's the trick. If you can notice that you're experiencing jealousy and stop demonizing it, you're already going to be head and shoulders above where most people are. And then if you can go one step further and just start noticing that what jealousy feels like in your body so that you can identify it sooner. I identified a 5-step framework that people who navigate jealousy more smoothly, what they do. And that's in the masterclass. It's also, if you get on my email list, you'll get a document that has it all in it. So I outline the framework. But the first step is just knowing how to identify that jealousy is on the scene. Because most of the time, it's not till we're like spinning a story up in our head and now we're way down the path. So how does jealousy feel for you? Can you remember a time when you were jealous sometime in your life? Can you, like, picture a moment?
You know, it's interesting because I was just thinking back to like my last relationship, and so many times we think of jealousy in a form of jealous of another individual. But, you know, the first thing that came to mind when you asked me this is jealous of his time with his friends and or at the bar. Mm-hmm. And I never put words to that until literally this moment, but that's what it was. It was a jealousy that I wasn't getting time and the bar and his bros were getting time.
Yeah. So that's a beautiful moment because that you're appropriately labeling jealousy there. We can identify jealousy because there's a triangle. There's you, the jealous one. There's your partner. He's the valued other, right? The beloved. And then there's the perceived interrupter. And a perceived interrupter, it could be somebody sliding up into your honey's DMs. Absolutely could be. But it can absolutely be somebody you imagine, or it can be a place or an energy that takes their attention away, right? Like, so we have to find that interrupter, because if there's no interrupter, then what we actually have is envy. So if my best friend like gets a new phone, then and I want their phone, I'm envying them. I might envy the money they have to buy it or the freedom they have to buy it. But if my best friend makes a new best friend and is posting pictures on Facebook, now I'm in jealousy. And envy can live inside jealousy. Oh, jealousy is so gnarly and messy. I love it so much. Jealousy is delicious because it's so complicated. But when you are in that situation where you know that your partner's attention is going somewhere else, you're triggered into a jealous feeling. What does it feel like in your body?
I mean, I feel it right now. It's like my throat's on fire. My stomach feels like it's turning a little bit. And I just feel like, ugh.
Yeah. So you're spot on. People tend to mention things about their stomach. They mention heat. They mention clenching, constriction, tingles, knots, all of the heaviness. And it tends to be located somewhere in their trunk or down to their belly so frequently. I happen to get tingles behind my ears, but I've been collecting these somatic responses to jealousy for a long time now. And what's interesting is that when people know their signals of jealousy, well, great, awesome. Now you can identify it faster. So if you're in a new relationship and you start noticing this pattern of you getting this, your mouth, the corners of your mouth pulled back. So there's some disgust there, right? So you're feeling some disgust and you're feeling some revulsion in your belly. All of these are feelings that you're feeling inside your jealousy, but the somatic cues, they let you identify it so that you can appropriately take your next steps. And now we walk through the rest of the framework.
I love that. I cannot wait to go A, join your mailing list, but B, check out this masterclass, because I think that we all experience jealousy. And like you said, we're not talking about it, and having some tools in our toolbox for navigating it when it does happen, because it's going to happen. You're right. Going to have jealousy in friendship. You're going to have jealousy. I mean, like you said, if a friend is spending more time with another friend, like it shows up everywhere. Jealousy at work. Somebody gets a promotion and you don't, or.
Right. Everywhere. And so. Right. So if you're experiencing, let's say you're experiencing that, somebody gets a promotion, there's envy popping up, right? I want what they have, or I want to be who they are. And the crappy thing is, I have to deal with these messy feelings. And if I'm using language that isn't quite clear, right, I might not even know how to turn to Google even to get help, let alone, right? And this is where I find people really, I am all for you using whatever words you want to describe it. But when we started using the word jelly, to say like, oh, I'm so jelly of those shoes, right? Like in 2010, that's so 2010 of me. When we started doing that, we conflated jealousy and envy, and then people lost another route to figuring out how to deal with each of these, right? Because envy, I want to approach through, I want to go into my self-worth. I want to look at what am I looking for? What is my underlying need? What do I want in my life? Because jealousy and envy are worked with differently. And envy can be an inspiration, right? We could use it as motivation and inspiration to move toward what we want. So can jealousy, but jealousy often is about fearing that we're going to lose someone, right? It's about fear of an interruption. So rather than shoring up just my self-worth, though certainly that can be important, I also need to turn my attention to my partner and question, have I made agreements that actually work for me? Or am I expecting them to read my mind and behave in this relationship in a way that I want them to? because that's what a lot of us are doing. I still find myself doing that some days. Just 2 days ago, I told my anchor partner, I really want you to, I know you just asked me, I just want you to read my mind. So I know I don't get you to, like, I'm calling myself out here, but what I want is for you to read my mind. It's normal and we have to stop it. We have to call ourselves out and say, that's what I want. And so I'm going to give you the gift of using the magic that we were given. We were all given a magic spell and we don't use it enough. It's called language and we get to use it to help other people read our minds.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
You know, it's funny that you bring up language because something that I have found is that the more books I read for pleasure that are unrelated to work, the more language and vocabulary I have for expressing myself. And I feel like for many of us, we really just lack the language to communicate what we need and want and desire and just period to communicate.
Right, right. And, you know, reading audiobooks counts. It counts. Like we've done the studies. We have the data. We know that reading audiobooks, and please call it that. You're reading the audiobook. That's what you're doing. It's a book. You are reading it. So if you happen to be oriented to listening and you're listening to a podcast, so this might be you, awesome. Audiobooks are your friend. And so many people discount them or they feel ashamed about that. Nope, it works. Use it. I do. I read about half of my books by audio.
Ooh. For me, my attention span is way too short and I lose track with audio and then I missed an entire chapter and I'm like, I have no clue what happened. So I actually am a paper girl 100%.
Yes. I mean, I have a library around me right now that is all devoted to my paper books and I do have a deep and abiding love for them. I do bring them to bed. It's real.
Oh, I have three sitting next to my bed right now.
Yeah.
I love it. Wow, Jolie, this has been amazing conversation and I really, really love talking with you. We could go on for hours. I really want to know, what is one single conversation that can reignite your sex life?
That is a great question. Okay, I'm going to answer it relatively quickly because I have a guide for you that will take you the rest of the way. So if you want to reignite your sex life, I want you to ask your partner, I want you to set up a time to ask a partner, or if you're solo, I want you to set aside a half an hour to really think on this question. What is sex? How do I know when sex has started? How do I know I'm having sex? How do I know when it's finished? What is sex? I teach sex educators, sex therapists. Often I'm in a room, a great big room filled with people who are well-educated on sex. Ask them to define what sex is. Our definitions will not match. That's normal. So when I really contemplate what sex is and I go to the work of writing down what sex is, even just in a couple sentences, stuff starts to move. What I've noticed is that when people walk through this exercise of figuring out what sex is, especially with any given partner, even somebody you're only having a hookup with, like, what is sex? How will we know when we're having it? The sex gets better. And all of a sudden now we're using words that we may have been afraid to use before. And there's so much else that we can go into so much more depth. But if you want to have this conversation, I made a 2-page guide to just walk you right through this question. So if you go to listentojolie.com, listentojolie, J-O-L-I.com, you'll get on my mailing list. And that guide is in there. The jealousy guide is in there. And three other of my guides are in there too. But those two big ones, you guys are going to want them. So just go grab them.
Yes. I love that. Thank you for sharing that with the listeners. Where else can they find you at?
Yeah. So you can find me on TikTok and Instagram at Dr. Jolie underscore Hamilton. So DrJoli underscore Hamilton, like the musical. And if you're interested in opening, go to the Year of Opening and check it out. TheYearOfOpening.com is where I talk about how do we do this without screwing everything up. And join me there and see if that might be up your alley.
Yes. Thank you so much for chatting with me. And also be sure to check out her podcast, Playing with Fire, as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Jordan.
This podcast is sponsored by Intimacy Coaching by Jordan Donnell. Have you ever desired more from your sex life? or feel like you're having good sex but curious about how to make it even better? Are you desiring a deeper intimate connection with yourself? Or maybe you are dealing with desire and arousal concerns or struggling with communicating your desires with your partner. If you're hearing this and thinking, that might be me, and you're curious to learn a bit more, let's chat. I would love to talk with you more to see if working with me is a good fit for you. To learn more about intimacy coaching with Jordan Donnell, go to coaching.jordandonnell.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast.
Thank you for joining today and continuing to bring awareness to women's health. If you love the show, please subscribe so you never miss another episode and leave a review for others to see. If you want to see me on the daily, you can check out my bio for links to all my pages. Be sure to share this episode with your girlfriends. Thanks again and see you next episode.